nothing to eat, but she stole a few leaves from the young plant in the communal garden, and her dreams grew lengthy and warm and elastic. Was it then that she saw the excavation and the hole in the ground? Perhaps other events occurred as well, but she no longer recalled them. She drummed her fingers on the cold bed and hummed to herself, and the music comforted her. When she woke after the third night, a young woman was sitting in her father's chair with a bag of white rabbit sweets in her lap. Julie stared at the woman, but could not remember who she was. Nevertheless, she said politely,
"Good morning, older sister."
"Pack your things," the woman said firmly.
Her words were oddly accented, because the candy had made her teeth sticky. Julie took the five objects that were nearest to her, which included a dress, a washcloth, and two of her father's records. They walked under the village gates and towards the next town. Julie knew she had been to town before, but she could not remember why. Nothing looked familiar. They came to a roundabout with a half-dozen soot-colored minibuses. The white rabbit muttered that her parents were lucky not to have their heads chopped off. They were fortunate that the worst excesses were a thing of the past.
"They have been sent for re-education, that's all," she said. "Since you've never been educated at all, it seemed pointless to send you along with them."
Inside the bus, the rim of the windowsill overflowed with the husks of sunflower seeds. Every time Julie moved, the plastic bag with her belongings crackled like a witch laughing. The countryside appeared to be breaking up into a rubble of shapes, tilting huts, splattered concrete, and blocks of ash. People appeared from every road, moving and running to keep up with something she couldn't see. The white rabbit talked a lot, but her voice seemed to pass over Julie's head and out the window. She looked down at her feet and saw that her cloth shoes were muddy and that she had a violet bruise on her left knee. The more she stared at it, the bluer and deeper it seemed to grow. She must have fallen asleep, because when she woke, there was a big moon outside the bus, and also a patter of electric lights, but everything else was darkness. The bus seemed to turn around in many circles before finally stopping, and everyone suddenly leaped into action, pulling down bags and birds and chickens. A dog ran onto the bus, and people ran off. The woman smelled of the sweets she had been eating all evening. They walked. There were many people on the sidewalks, and Julie's bag scratched against their legs. "The white rabbit is taking me to my mother," she thought. Julie quickened her steps, and, as the woman hurried along too, Julie feared that she might snap, lift with happiness, and break apart as soon as her mother took her in her arms. The bag cackled and snickered beside her. "To my mother, to my mother, to Ma, to Ma." They came to an archway, a lane, and then an alleyway. She followed the woman along the rows of doors, so similar they all seemed to be children from one another. The white rabbit chose one and stopped.
"These are your relatives. Knock here and ask for your aunt."
The lady knelt down and gave her one last candy and an envelope with red letterhead. She touched Julie's knee, and the big round bruise, which Julie had forgotten about, shot pain up her leg all the way to her eyes.
"Good luck, Julie," the woman said,
and then she too disappeared. Julie faced the door, listening to the echoing sound of the woman's footsteps. She waited for the pain in her knee to subside, and she slipped the candy into the envelope. After waiting what seemed a long time, she lifted her hand and knocked. The eerie creaking of the door made her shiver. A teenaged boy appeared.
He had uncombed hair and nice eyebrows.
"I'm looking for my aunt?"
Zhu Li cried. His eyebrows lifted. He saw the two records angling out of her plastic bag.
"Bach,"
she said. "Bach." The teenager's eyes and the door opened wider.
"You should tell my aunt that I'm here,"
she said firmly. She shoved the paper with red letterhead against his stomach. Late that night, she woke up alert and saw moonlight on her exposed feet. There were monsters beside her on the bed, her cousins, she later learned, Flying Bear and Da Shan. She crawled away from them and out of the room, towards a light waving at her in the distance. "To mother, to mother." Zhu Li was pulled forward until she reached that room. Two candles were lit, and their fire swayed like unsteady feet. She saw Sparrow's teacup first, and then his hand, and then his arm connected to his shoulder, and so on, until she reached his eyes. He was not surprised to see her. She wanted to cry, but she climbed onto a chair beside him, as if waiting to have her fortune read. Her cousin was doing his homework, and she picked up a pencil, thinking that she could do something for him. Sparrow got up and gave her a cup of tea. She requested a task, and he thought for a moment, then gave her some paper and a list of words which he instructed her to copy. She could not read all of them, but reading seemed secondary. Ba had taught her how to copy neatly. All she wanted was the paper and the pencil, and something to do. The list of words must have come from Flying Bear's homework, some kind of vocabulary lesson about the word shu, book. For years, she kept this sheet of paper, written in her child's hand. Qin shu, a story that is sung. Jin shu, a band book. Ting shu, to listen to a performance of storytelling. Shi shu, the book of songs, and the book of history. Mo shu, to write from memory. Chuan shu ge, carrier pigeon. Hui guo shu, a written repentance. Niao chong shu, bird writing, a style of calligraphy. Jian tao shu, self-criticism. After her pencil was dulled and her teacup twice emptied, Sparrow lifted her up and returned her to the shared bed. She asked him where the plastic bag had gone away to. He said nothing. She told him that she had wanted to keep the old qin, but it was too late. What had they done to it? Had her devotion to the qin caused her parents' suffering? Perhaps she was not speaking aloud because he still didn't answer. "I did this," Zhu Li thought. "How did I do this? Because of me, Old West's treasures have all been taken away." Her parents came back to her in a rush of images. Was she powerless or powerful? Had Zhu Li herself opened the door to the demons who barged in? Her parents had been roped together as if they were oxen. Why had her mother wept for pity? How had the men known, Zhu Li thought, that she was part girl and part sky? A Yao, who had been seduced by wood and strings that were not alive. But the qin was alive, she thought, fighting sleep. She and it were the very same thing. The next day, Sparrow sat her down in front of the record player and played all the music he could find. Her cousin listened with his eyes closed, and Zhu Li copied him and did the same. Inside her head, the music built columns and arches. It cleared a space within and without, a new consciousness. So there were worlds buried inside other worlds. But first you had to find the opening and the entryway Sparrow showed her how to remove the record from its paper sleeve, how to set it on the turntable, how to place the needle in its groove. Everything in Big Mother Knife's house was careful and considered, a world away from the bullying she had recently endured. Everything in Ba Lut's home made music. Duli watched them all play their instruments. She watched their hands and bodies. She let the music write itself into her memory. She felt, as with the Qin, that she had always known this music, that they recognized one another. There was a small violin that belonged to Flying Bear, which he shunned. One day, she sat beside it for several hours, and finally she placed it on her lap, like the old Qin, and tentatively plucked the strings. She did this day after day, but her cousin told her, "It's not a zither, and in any case, you're too young to learn the violin." She continued for nearly a week, and finally Sparrow took the violin from her, lifted Flying Bear's bow, and began to play. It was too small for him, and his body folded around the instrument as if to prevent its voice from escaping. Julie recognized that voice. She felt she had known it longer than she had known life. Sparrow became her first violin teacher. Later, when she was 8, he passed her on to Professor Tan at the conservatory. She accepted every word, gesture, and criticism. Her teacher was blunt, and during his tantrums, Julie feared he would smash her violin on the floor or break it on her head. But it was all drama. Professor Tan recognized that in each piece that she played, she heard more and more music. But what was music? Every note could only be understood by its relation to those around it. Merged, they made new sounds, new colors, a new resonance or dissonance, a stability or rupture. Inside, the pure tone of C was a ladder of rich overtones, as well as the echoes of other seas, like a man wearing many suits or clothes, or a grandmother carrying all her memories inside her. Was this what music was? Was it time itself containing fractions of seconds, minutes, hours, and all the ages, all the generations? What was chronology, and how did she fit into it? How had her father and mother escaped from time, and how could they ever come back? When Ma finally returned home after 6 years in the desert camps, Duli wondered what words she could possibly say to her. There were no words adequate to the feeling between them. One night, Duli played the opening of Handel's Xerxes for her mother. It was the simplest of songs, romantic, maybe even deadly with bourgeois sentiment. Of course, it was no Stravinsky, and yet, in the middle of the aria, Julie felt as if her arms and her body were disappearing. She felt the only reality was this wire of tension between herself and Ma. It was the one true, unfinished movement of her life. In this room, there was only the act of listening. There was only swirl, a counting down and a counting up, the beginning that could never be a real beginning. Her mother stared at her as if she did not recognize her daughter. "Ma," Julie had wanted to say, "it was my fault. I found this opening in the ground. I should have been sent away, not you. But don't you see how long I've waited for you? Don't you see how much I've tried to improve myself? I only exist now. I only..." If she put the violin down, would the real Julie, the one they had left behind, appear as surely as night after day? If there was no me, she thought, great-grandfather West's container would never have been discovered. Her parents would not have been condemned. These notes would not sound, An insignificant soul like hers could break the world, but never remake it. What was the world becoming? Her mother was sickly pale, and the hollows in her face reminded Julie of the grave itself. One blunt motion and swirl would fold. And yet, Julie thought, we are alive now. I am alive. My mother is alive. It is a new age, a new beginning, and we are here. Chapter 7. In the spring of 2000, after my mother passed away, I gave myself entirely to my studies. The logic of mathematics, its methods of induction and deduction, its power to describe abstract shapes that have no counterpart in the real world, sustained me. I moved out of the apartment that my mother had been renting ever since she and Ba first came to Canada, in which I had grown up. Desperate to leave it behind, I cobbled together every penny I had and bought a dilapidated apartment on Alexander Street. The windows looked straight out into the port of Vancouver, and, at night, the endless arrivals and departures of multicolored shipping containers, what they held, what they divulged, comforted me. I kept my parents' papers in the bedroom closet, in a canter, quote, taped to the wall. The essence of mathematics lies in its freedom, and like a child, I distracted myself by imagining numbers so immense, so limitless, they far exceeded all the atoms in the universe. Numbers real and imaginary were a language inside me. Equations were branching of substance and shadow, relationships and interrelationships, randomness and pattern, the fractional, incomplete, yet consistently ordered world we live in. I listened to my father's records, but thought only of intervals, frequency, and temperament, of the expression of numbers in an inaudible world. By the time I turned 25, I had finished my PhD, and thanks to a well-received paper I had published in Inventiones Mathematiche, I was offered teaching positions in Canada, the United States, Korea, and Germany. To the surprise of my professors, I chose to stay in Vancouver. A year later, I was teaching Galois theory, calculus, and number theory, as well as a seminar on the symmetry and combinatorial structure of Bach-Goldberg variations. I had a small but close circle of friends. In and out of my research time, I continued to be preoccupied by Ma's death and by the statistical improbability of finding Aiming. My mind was full of numbers. I was not lonely. Yet I understood, even then, that my life was strange, shaped by questions that seemed to have multiple and conflicting answers. In 2006, the year I turned 27, I made my first visit to Hong Kong. For the next 10 days, I disappeared into the crowds, nightclubs, and bars of Mong Kok, returning to my rented room at 7 a.m. and sleeping until mid-afternoon. Ever since Ma's death, work had been my entire existence. I had become, without knowing it, the perfect caricature of a reclusive professor. Or, as G.H. Hardy described mathematics, the most austere and the most remote. In the concentrated work of trying to prove a theorem, social life fell by the wayside. But here, in Hong Kong's neon lights and perpetual noise, I let myself be someone else entirely. Walking home as the city woke, miles from sober, I felt happy, for the first time in many years. Finally, the day before I was due to fly home, I willed myself to find the dwelling in which Ba had been living, the last one since he had moved several times during the final months of his life. The address, 9F Alhambra Building, 202 San Tinde, was known to me from police and coroner reports, which concluded, the deceased Jiang Kai, burdened by gambling debts, suffering from acute depression, committed suicide by jumping from his 9th-floor window. 16 years later, the building was still there, and I wondered how much it had changed, if at all, since 1989. There was no lobby. There was not even a door, just a gray staircase that led up from the street. I went up, passing room after room, metal grates or small altars offering oranges to the ancestors were all that separated each dwelling from the stairwell. The apartments were minuscule, with barely enough space for a bed. I saw windows the size of a sheet of paper. I climbed higher and higher. The door to 9F was closed, and though I stood before it for a full half hour, I could not bring myself to knock. I had an irrational fear that Ba would open the door, that I would face the window he had climbed through. I turned around and ascended. After leaving the building, I took a taxi to the district office of the Hong Kong police, where I requested a copy of my father's file. An officer helped me fill out an application for access to information, telling me that I would receive a reply by post within 30 days. I left the police station and wandered aimlessly, standing on an overpass that crossed a 6-lane thoroughfare, and despite the noise of traffic and the vibration of the entire structure, I could hear nothing. My life felt entirely out of order. I took the subway almost all the way to the Chinese border, switched to a bus, and then walked up a paved road. My father's only request had been to be buried at this cemetery, a place whose name brings together the characters He, harmony, and He, to close, to be reunited. But I did not know, and had never known, exactly where his ashes lay. In the cemetery office, I was surprised to find they had no record of him at all. The young man at the desk asked, bored but apologetic, if it was possible that my mother had scattered his ashes in the Garden of Remembrance. "It's possible," I said. "She never told me." The man returned to his paperwork, and I went outside. All the graves were set on narrow terraces, rising upwards along concrete steps. After walking for several hours in the heat, I was drenched in sweat and could barely see. Crickets cried unceasingly, and the butterflies were delicate yet large as handkerchiefs. Above me, cotton balls that seemed to come from nowhere glided through the air. I came by chance to a small columbarium where, inside, 4 tiny teacups and 4 pairs of red chopsticks lay waiting on a sheet of newspaper. Square niches, for holding urns and ashes, were mounted on the walls. But some squares were empty. These had only cardboard covers with 2 characters written in red marker, G, fortunate, and Yu, jade. What this meant, I could not fathom. The room was soft with spider webs, and the teacups and chopsticks appeared to have been left behind by ghosts. Desperate to find him, but afraid too, I studied all the pictures one by one. His picture was not there. I left the columbarium and walked between the graves, but still, Ba could not be found. At last I sat down on the steps of a long walkway. A worker clothed in blue passed by, with a white towel tucked into the collar of his uniform. He wanted to help, but I could not communicate what it was that I wished for, and finally he left me where I was, under the sun, thinking of my parents. 4 weeks later, A small box arrived at my office at the university. Inside were a number of documents, police and autopsy reports, some of which my mother had already received. There were a dozen photographs of my father's body, his clothes and few possessions. There were also letters I had never seen before, 8 from my mother and 5 from Sparrow. One of Sparrow's letters contained a composition 31 pages long, the pages taped together. A sonata for piano and violin called "The Sun Shines on the People's Square." At the top, Sparrow had written, "For Zhang Kai." The pages, copied by hand, were dated May 27, 1989. A one-page report stapled to it took me many minutes to decipher. Finally, I understood that these pages had been accidentally misfiled, and the error had only come to light in 1997, during the digitization of all police files. Because so many years had passed and the file was now closed, they were releasing the original documents to me, the only surviving family member. I was looking at letters that even my mother had never seen, not when she went to Hong Kong to bury my father, and not later on, when she too requested the file. I took everything home. That night, I read through the pages slowly, once, twice, 3 times. I woke up in the night and reread it. The photographs of my father's body, the cold detachment of the report, and the details of the inquiry opened up emotions I could not stand to feel. Finally, I put the papers back into the box, and the box under my desk. I went on with my life, returning to the world of numbers. Their possibilities, their language and structure, filled me. They were as beloved, alive and universal as music. Not long after I met a colleague who was also a professional musician, a violinist. His name was Yasunari, and he became my closest friend. One night, I gave Sparrow's manuscript to him, confiding its origins. Yasunari said he would arrange everything. A few weeks later, I went to his apartment. We opened a bottle of wine, toasted the composer, and then I sat on the sofa and listened. I had never heard Sparrow's music before, but as the violin and piano began, I felt a strange humming, as if I had heard this music in my childhood. Perhaps it was an echo of Bach's Sonata No. 4, an echo of that recording of Glenn Gould and Yehudi Menuhin I would later chance upon in Chinatown. It was as if I knew this person and had always known him. In that piece of music, I imagined I heard 3 voices, piano, violin, and composer. And in their separateness, they carried sorrow, yes, but also, how can I describe it? Inside "The Sun Shines on the People's Square," I heard an unbroken space protecting all 3, and also a limitlessness, an ever-expanding room like the desert. All of my unanswerable questions seemed to circle within the notes. At the intersection of piano and violin, between the music and the pauses, the rests. How did a composer live his life unheard? Could music record a time that otherwise left no trace? I walked home. Lights on the ski hills gleamed faintly behind the clouds, leaving a blue wash in an otherwise darkened sky. I thought about my father, about his love for Sparrow and Julie. How many notes are there in Bach's Goldberg Variations, in Shostakovich's 5th Symphony? How many words are each of us granted over the course of a lifetime? That night, I began writing down my memories of Ai Ming. I wrote slowly at first, and then the story quickened. I hoped that writing would allow me, finally, to keep the promise I had made to Ma. I wanted, as Ai Ming did, to move forward, to take a further step. A few months later, Yasunari asked me to marry him, and I did. I was 28 years old, but still far too young and unsettled in myself. Indeed, I might go so far as to say that I was hostile to myself. I was, in so many ways, my father's daughter. I broke Yasunari's heart when, after only a short time, I abandoned our marriage, and I felt as if I had torn my own future into pieces. My father's death consumed me. A rift had opened between my thoughts and my emotions, and one day I woke with the sensation that I was falling through that rift and would fall forever. I was drawn to suicide. Time passed. My emotional life was, as Big Mother Knife would say, as firm as a stack of eggs. And yet, during this time, my research flourished. Blindly, I followed the first principle of pure mathematics, the hunger for beauty. In number theory, we say that beauty exists in the machinery. Unexpectedly, my work on elliptical curves won a French number theory award, and the revered journal Annals of Mathematics published one of my papers. My name was put forward for a Meadows Prize. I wondered at the absurdity of things. I had no explanation, except perhaps that I fell asleep as one person and woke as another. The surface of my life confounded me. Yet, in the world of numbers, everything felt possible. Numbers had no substance, and were made entirely of thought. My mother's voice returned to me. If you're trapped in a room and nobody is coming to save you, what can you do? You have to bang on the walls and break the windows. Li Ling, you have to climb out by yourself. Month after month, my father's copy of Sparrow's Sonata sat in a drawer, waiting. I woke one morning, unable to deny this truth, that the love I carried for Ba had survived undimmed. In 2010, I traveled for the first time to mainland China. I was attending a number theory conference in Hangzhou, but it was Weibo and QQ, Chinese social media sites, that absorbed me. As many as 700 million Chinese, more than 50% of the population, regularly access the Internet. Until recently, 60% of Internet users did not use their real names. As of 2013, anonymity became illegal. The Great Firewall, as it is commonly known, routinely deletes 16% of all Chinese Internet conversations. Looking for Ai Ming in cyberspace was trying to pluck a needle from the sea. But I saw, too, that the Internet was a series of doors. All I had to do was create the door she could open. I began posting scanned copies of Chapter 17 of the Book of Records. I also posted jokes I knew Ai Ming would love. For instance, the Yoda embedding, contravariant it is. Or, Q, how do you tell an extroverted mathematician from an introverted one? A, an extroverted mathematician stares at your shoes when talking to you. Every post was a letter to the possible. From Hangzhou, I took the train to Shanghai, where I visited the conservatory. I found nothing on Kai, Zhu Li, or Sparrow. It was as if they had never been. That night in Shanghai, I fell asleep to the clamor of radios, a profusion of opera, disco, Beethoven, shouting, and speech. When I woke, nothing stirred. It was as if my bed had fallen into outer space. In English, consciousness and unconsciousness are part of a vertical plane, so that we wake up, and we fall asleep, and we sink into a coma. Chinese uses the horizontal line so that to wake is to cross a border towards consciousness, and to faint is to go back. Meanwhile, time itself is vertical, so that last year is the year above, and the next year is the year below. The day before yesterday, 前天, is the day in front, and the day after tomorrow, 后天, is the day behind. This means that future generations are not the generations ahead, but the ones behind. 后代. Therefore, to look into the future, one must turn around. A mirroring echo of Walter Benjamin's famous evocation of the angel of history. The storm irresistibly propels him into the future, to which his back is turned, while the pile of debris before him grows skyward. How we map time, how it becomes lived and three-dimensional to us, how time is bent and elastic and repeated, has informed all my research, proofs, and equations. When I was a child, I would continuously pester Aiming. Don't stop! What happened to Swirl and Big Mother Knife? Or, what happened to Zhu Li? Don't let it finish. She had come into my life at the crux of her own. She was a sister to me. From the beginning we were joined. Two halves of the world Sparrow and Kai had left behind. Long after she departed, Aiming's voice tugged away at my thoughts, returning me again and again to the same ever-expanding, ever-contracting piece of music. Could I awake now and cross towards her? Near the end, she seemed almost to forget that I was there, and it was as if the story came from the room itself, a conversation overheard, a piece of music still circling the air. Zhu Li was in room 103, following the magisterial Prokofiev up his porcelain staircases, when Kai entered without knocking. She ignored him. Prokofiev required all her concentration. Every measure brought her closer to the disgraced Russian, who had been accused by Stalin of formalism, his major compositions banned. Yet in this room, Prokofiev was becoming flesh and blood, while Zhu Li herself was vanishing. From eighths to sixteenths, then three times as fast, the notes chipped into one another. Every note had to touch the air, make its singular gesture, and elaborate this unending melody. And then the music stopped. Her bow stopped. It was as if she could hear nothing, or had forgotten everything, or had been pushed under water. Trembling, she lowered her violin. Kai and Sparrow had only just returned from Wuhan the previous day. She had heard Sparrow coming in after midnight. Kai was still watching her. "What do you want?" She hadn't meant to say it so brusquely, but the expression on his face, the pity, enraged her. "I reserved this room until 11 o'clock, and as you know, the piano is in terrible condition anyway. Will you come upstairs with me?" Ah, she thought, looking back at her violin, glimpsing her own reflection. Who was real, and who was false? "Comrade Zhu Li," he said. "Something has happened." She wiped the strings of her bow, latched her violin case, and followed him out of the room. At the staircase, he took hold of her hand briefly. All the way to the fourth floor, her hand prickled with heat and discomfort. She heard yelling above them. The staircase became chaotic. Zhu Li was separated from Kai and pushed down the corridor. On both sides, the walls were covered with Da Zi Bao, big character posters, the same as had appeared in Bingpai long ago. She glimpsed the word Yao, which seemed to crawl from sheet to sheet. Someone or something was being denounced. The language of these attacks was copied from newspaper editorials. These were the same words that spilled endlessly from party cadres and shouting loudspeakers. We must sweep away the horde of demons who have entrenched themselves in cultural institutions. She stopped, and students pushed roughly past her, laughing. Break the bourgeois specialists, scholars, authorities, and venerable masters, and trample every bit of their prestige into the dust. Without realizing it, she had reached the office of He Luting, the president of the conservatory, and she heard absurdly music. Could Professor He truly be practicing inside his quarters? Yet there was no piano in his office, and so the music, Debussy's Petite Suite, with its uneasy mixture of triviality and sorrow, must be coming from a recording. Julie fought a hysterical wave of laughter. She had not heard Debussy for months, not since the composer had been targeted in Wenhuibao and the Beijing papers. His music labeled decadent, and the long-dead Frenchman, a composer whose elaborate impressionist cookery was an insult to the hardships of the poor. Sparrow had confiscated all her Debussy scores and put them who knows where.
"But Le Plus Galant is inside my mind," she had said, handing the music over. "Can you erase the impressionist cookery in my mind?"
The longest, most vitriolic poster had been affixed to Professor He's door. The sheet, torn from butcher paper, was as tall as she was, and the calligraphy, very square, was oddly beautiful. It was surrounded by other smaller posters. Julie stepped closer, the words wavering. The ink looked so freshly black, she thought she could wipe the malicious words off with her hands. She had almost touched the word Yao when Kai came up beside her. She turned to him, her hand outstretched, and, out of nervousness, smiled. Her attention was caught by the dozens of posters continuing down the hallway. The words jeered and seemed to move, to come loose and slide along the walls. She saw a long essay, written in ungainly calligraphy, filled with names and this list of scholars and specialists, including Sparrow, Ba Lut, Professor Tan, and a dozen more teachers and musicians. Stunned, she went closer. Petite Suite trickled and teased through the walls. It was the piano, not the names, that made her shudder. The music came to her as if she were watching a dozen points of glass falling towards them. "There are more posters," Kai said, "in the courtyard and on the gates."
"But who is targeting them?" she said.
She should have lowered her voice, but she did not.
"Why are they denouncing my uncle?"
Kai was already pushing back into the crush of people, some chanting, some grinning like opera-goers. Here were Biscuit and her page-turners, as Julie called them, and here were the string class, as if they always traveled ensemble. Julie said,
"Ba Lut performed for Chairman Mao."
Nobody seemed to hear her, except Biscuit, who looked at Julie with unexpected kindness.
"My uncle was a hero at headquarters," Julie told her. "He led a battalion of the new Fourth Route Army."
Biscuit blinked nervously and looked away. Kai took her hand and pulled her behind him. At the end of the corridor, the noise lessened. How hot it was! How desperately humid! Yet Kai's hand was cool and dry. She clutched the handle of her violin case, stood very still, and listened with all her strength. But under the bursts of contemptuous laughter, she no longer heard the Debussy. Outside, the posters were more precise and prescriptive. When Julie had arrived this morning, just before 6 a.m., the walls had been bare, so the posters must have been passed up in broad daylight, with the approval of the class committees, or even... Julie's thoughts became confused. Big Mother Knife had been right. A new campaign was underway. Stand up and rebel. Kill those who would sabotage our revolution. Stand up and be free. It's not just here, Kai said as he led her through the East Gate. This morning, there are denunciations at Jiao Tong University, and even at the Beijing universities at Tsinghua and Beida. They all say the same thing. On Fenyang Road, people flowed to work, talking, complaining, pulling children, weighed down by bags, water drums, instruments, birds, chairs, unidentifiable metal objects, pushed forward by hunger, routine, necessity, even joy. The air was sticky. Julie wanted to crouch down with her throbbing hands over her ears and block out the sun and the noise. No, she decided suddenly, her thoughts clearing. Those denunciations, those posters, could not be real.
How was your trip to Wuhan?
She spoke the words casually, as if they had just now met on the street.
Sparrow looked exhausted when he got up this morning, and yet here you are, already hard at work.
He looked at her steadily, as if trying to hear between the words.
I slept on the bus.
And did you and my cousin come home with recordings full of music?
Kai still said nothing. He reminded her of a cat with one paw raised, about to touch the ground, momentarily confused.
That was your mission, wasn't it?
She reminded him.
To traverse the countryside, to record and preserve the folk songs of our motherland.
Whose words was she using, she wondered. She forced herself to look him in the eye.
Oh, he said, one hand shading his face from the sun. We came back with 3 reels.
She wanted to beg him to come away with her, to come and play for a few hours, or to go to the music library and browse the old recordings. There was a Shostakovich string quartet she longed to hear. Instead, she said carelessly,
I have to go. I left my scores in room 103.
Forget them. Go home, Julie.
I'm no prodigy like you, she said. I don't improve by merely wishing it.
This is the start of a new campaign, don't you understand?
The sincerity in his eyes brought both hope and fury to her. He said,
The Red Guards can turn your life to ashes. They will.
Before I met you, Julie thought, I had no one to please but myself. Jiang Kai, you are as real and unreal as the shadow of an airplane. She wanted to ask Kai if he loved Sparrow for who he was, or if it was his talent that was the true attraction. Didn't he understand that a gift like Sparrow's could not be bought or borrowed? It could not be stolen? Did Kai love the person, or did he love what Sparrow's music made him feel? Her own thoughts surprised and upset her. She nodded brightly.
Until they do, I can only practice.
He smiled at her, in the way that Balut sometimes smiled thinly at Flying Bear. Kai reached into his satchel and withdrew a sheaf of music.
Don't be stubborn, he said. Take these.
She stared down. He had placed in her hands familiar pieces by the deceased composer, Xian Xinghai, a hero of the revolution. In her bewilderment, she felt entirely alone. The concrete buildings, crowded roads, and all the passers-by seemed to move inside a light that didn't reach her.
Jiang Kai, she said spitefully. Now I understand. I'll forget Prokofiev. I'll play the March of the Volunteers and the Internationale for all eternity. The old world shall be destroyed. Arise, slaves, arise. Do not say that we have nothing. That should win me the Tchaikovsky competition and please everyone, you most of all.
There was his patronizing half-smile again.
Comrade Julie, Don't make the silly mistake of thinking your talent is enough.
My talent doesn't concern me, she said. What I need to know is, will Sparrow's talent protect him? That's what you and I care the most about, isn't it?
Instead of speaking, he painstakingly tied up his bag, which was patched in both corners and on the strap. He should conduct, Zhu Li thought. All his movements have the illusion of expressing so much. She wanted to ask him how he could acquiesce on the surface and not be compromised inside. You could not play revolutionary music, truly revolutionary music, if you were a coward in your heart. You could not play if your hands, your wrists, your arms were not free. Every note would be abject, weak, a lie. Every note would reveal you. Or perhaps she was wrong, and Kai was right. Maybe, no matter his or her convictions, a great musician, a true genius, could play any piece and be believed. She wanted to pull all these thoughts into questions, but by the time she had recovered herself, Kai had turned and walked away. The movement in the street rustled and shamed her. No one else had a moment to rest, to think, to be afraid. Yet here she was, with time on her hands. She looked down at the music he had given her, which she saw now had been transcribed for violin and copied out by hand. Midway through, the notes wobbled and tilted, as if running into the wind. It must have taken him hours. But why would Jiang Kai do such a thing for her? When did he have time? She began walking, directionless, fearful that the posters trailed behind her, like mud stuck to her shoes. The words counter-revolutionary, monsters, blind feeling, false love, witch. Inside her head, Ravel's Sigan refused to be quiet. It billowed on and revealed itself as the composition of a madman. To escape, she rushed between the bicycles to Xiangyang Park. The grain and oil lineups snaked past her, and a line of grandmothers stood in studied silence, clutching their ration coupons. The sun was high now, and the heat intolerable, but everyone seemed blank and unsweating. Of course, I will go back and find Kai and apologize, Zhu Li thought, even though she kept walking. How many self-criticisms had she written? 1,000 pages? 2,000? Yes, she was selfish and plagued by immoderate desires, and yes, her love for music was a weakness. She had confessed these faults since she was 8 years old, but she had stubbornly refused to purify her heart. Chairman Mao said, "To be aware of one's own mistakes and yet make no attempt to correct them means taking a liberal attitude to oneself." These people talk Marxism, but practice liberalism. Yes, this is how the minds of certain people work, and they are extremely harmful to the revolutionary collective. The park came like a sip of water. There was a shaded bamboo bench, and she sat down, her violin case on her lap. In the grass, a boy no more than 5 or 6 years old was curled up on the ground while his mother stood a few feet away. She wore a gray suit and a gray cap made of wool, a furnace in this humidity. The mother had a ball which she nudged towards her son, but the boy ignored her. Even the ball was gray. She retrieved it, turned and kicked it back to him. Still, her son did not move. He lay motionless in the grass like an injured animal. Minutes passed. The boy leaped up as if suddenly awakened. The boy went to the ball and faced his mother, but, unexpectedly, he turned and kicked the ball in the opposite direction. A thump echoed in the grove. The boy waited. The mother ran gracefully past her son and caught up with the ball. Undeterred, she returned it to him. Once again he made as if to return it, but then at the last moment gave it a hard kick in the opposite direction. Once more the mother chased it down. Again and again this scene repeated itself. The boy nastily kicking the ball away, the mother patiently retrieving it, the boy standing idly. Julie closed her eyes. When she opened them again, she saw that the torment had ended, and that the boy and his mother were playing. They dodged one another, fainted, floated the ball towards an imagined net. Julie slid sideways on the bench, opened her violin case, and stared at the instrument. She had a lunatic desire to smash it on the ground. Beyond the park, she heard what sounded like an encroaching sea, but was only Red Guards. "Down with Wu Bei," the students shouted. "Kill the traitor! Destroy the criminal gang! Down with Wu Bei! Down with Wu Bei!" The boy, who moments ago had been laughing in delight, inexplicably grew weary. His mother passed the ball to him, and he abruptly turned and walked away. The ball rolled past him, into the trees. He sat down. His mother ran after the ball, tapped it back to her son, and waited. When nothing happened, she pecked it forward again, but the boy was now prone in the grass. Still his mother circled him, the ball creeping ahead of her. They seemed oblivious to the shouting of the Red Guards at the outskirts of the park. She had never seen a child and a mother act in this manner. It was as if the world had fallen on its side, and the child had been shaken into irritable old age. The mother hovered in her shapeless gray suit. What was love to this child? It could be rescinded as easily as a command. "The more ruthless we are to enemies, the more we love the people. What will you sacrifice? What will you sacrifice? Stand up and serve the revolution." "Something is coming for me," Julie thought. "The more ruthless we are." "But an ocean," she thought, overcome suddenly by inappropriate laughter. "Only an ocean would destroy her." She closed the violin case and set it in carefully in the grass. Revel's Sagan slid over the shouting and covered her thoughts. Note by note, the music began again. It sounded so fiercely that her arms strained from hallucinatory exertion. Her shoulders ached, and yet the music in her thoughts played on lavishly. Music was pouring into the ground. Far away, the voices of the students sounded like weeping. "We must remake ourselves and change the world. We must serve the people with our hearts and minds. From the red east there rises a sun. In China there appears a Mao Zedong." Time, the park, the slogans, the mother and child. She pushed them all away. Time, the pressure of the strings against her fingers, the weightlessness of the bow, would not leave. When the last note ended, she awoke into the quiet. The demonstration had moved on. The grove was empty, and the mother and the boy had vanished, as if they had never been. Even the patch of shadow in which they had stood was gone. There was someone watching her. The haze in the air and her own distraction had made her careless, and she had not noticed this other person. He stood up now and came towards her. Julie finally recognized him. Tofu Liu, her classmates called him, mockingly. He was a soft-hearted, soft-spoken violinist. He was almost camouflaged, both his trousers and shirt were the same shade of army green.
"Long live Chairman Mao," he said, "and long live our glorious revolution."
"Long may it flourish. Long live the great Communist Party of China."
"Comrade Julie," he said, "I didn't mean to follow you. Actually, as it happens, I wanted to ask you. It's nothing really, so...
He remained standing.